Okay. So we ended at a point last week, if you'll remember, Jonathan and his armor bearer went up and did what Gideon did, kind of threw a fleece out there and said, hey, here's all these Philistines here. We're going to, you know, go up here and let the Lord lead and say, if these guys say this, we're going to do X. And if they say this, we're going to do Y. And it turned out that the Lord led them to attack the Philistines. And I guess they were so confident in their position that it kind of threw them into a tizzy. And then obviously the Lord was involved, so there were some supernatural things going on, and the camp of Israel per se did not even know that this was going on. Then all of a sudden they perceived all this going on. They found out that it was Jonathan and his armor bearer. In the midst of that, the Philistines are being routed. Things are looking really, really good for like Scott pointed out a couple times, they're actually called the Hebrews in this. But things are looking out really well for the Israelites. Saul steps in, and again, we've seen this a couple times as they've been along for the whole ride, and Joshua and all, and puts the country, the Israelites, under an oath. God never told him to do it. It's a we'll find out it has catastrophic, outcome, just like it did in Judges when a young woman was, you know, controversial whether she was actually sacrificed or had to, like, live in the temple for the rest of her days and never had a family and all those things. But, you know, we were just, the goal is to try to, you know, the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed. The New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. So we're always trying to look for places where things, you know, these are called the historical books. So as we're going through the history of Israel, that we can bring things into the future. And this is all those times, you know, I remember growing up, my dad struggled greatly with, he grew up in a coal mining town in West Virginia, and they had circuit preachers that would come through their coal mining town, and, you know, every time this circuit preacher came through the town, each one would have their own, I guess we would call it pet peeve, or like, he said one of the great things for them as kids was, you know, he grew up in a large family on a farm. They would get a Sunday paper, and each one would get a portion of the comics to read. They thought that was just the greatest. I mean, life was very, very simple, and the simple pleasures in life were, well, all of a sudden one pastor came through the town and said, on Sundays, to read the comics is a sin. Then, you know, another, they had a, evidently, you know, a lot of those coal mining towns had really, really good ball teams. And, you know, the work was actually 6 days a week, and Sunday was the only day they had off, so that was the day that they would play ball. And then it got, not only was playing ball a sin, but to go watch the game was a sin. So there was just all these, and the point of that was there's just constantly people that are going to lay rules on you that will have catastrophic effect on your Christian walk for no other, and that might be a great thing for them. The Lord, I can't see their heart, and there's probably many things in your life that the Lord's pressing upon you to say, hey, maybe you ought not to be, you know, we can turn anything into a god. You know, you see guys, I used to golf a bit at work with people, and you would see these young guys get hired, and they would take up golfing, and next thing you know, they had the best clubs and the best, and they would spend thousands, and they were doing it every day of the week, and so you can turn something as simple as golfing, which, you know, should be this relaxing, entertaining, next thing you know, it's a god that just rules over your life, and, you know, you can just set cars and all these things, and maybe in your life, God's telling you, hey, you know, take examine yourself, and you might want to pull back from this a little bit. But next thing you know, you turn it into your crusade that there should be no golf for anybody, or and it just it ends up hurting people. So on both sides of that, whether you have a conviction that this is something I shouldn't do or should scale back on, or, you know, you're the one trying to press upon other people, you're, you know, or somebody's pressing upon you that you shouldn't be doing this and be doing that. It's a very, very hurtful and dangerous game to play, and it's very, you should really, really, you know your heart and know the heart of God before you start putting your rules and regulations on people. And that's also when we start, Christianity is tough sometimes in the fact that you're, as humans, we are constantly competing for everything, for attention, for money, for all these things. And in Christianity, it bleeds over into that. And we're trying to measure our Christianity and how, you know, quote unquote Christian we can be, and we start measuring that by the rules that we put on our lives. Like, obviously this person's not as Christian as I am because they, you know, read the comics on Sunday or do all these things. And it's, you know, a human nature to try to measure yourself against that. So before we go on too much further, this is kind of the thing that Saul does here in, you know, they're having this great victory, things are going on, it's just like, you know, a young Christian that just gets saved, and all you know is I was a mess, and Jesus saved me and restored me, and you want to tell everybody about it, and, you know, people come along and say, well, you know, you need to go to Bible conference before you witness to people, because you got to have all your theology, and all your eschatology, and all your, you know, when, you know, you were totally happy with, my life was a wreck, Jesus saved me, pulled me out of the gutter, and I just want to tell everybody about it. And now you have a bunch of rules laid on you, and you end up being nowhere near as an effective Christian that you were just happy to be saved and loved. And so, back to that. And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day, so Saul laid an oath on the people, saying, cursed be the man who eats food until this evening, and I am avenged on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. So here we see a change in Saul in the fact that a lot of times we saw him early in his kingship that we were avenged on the Lord's enemies. All of a sudden now the people who are attacking become his enemies, and he's personalized it, and now it's going to be his victory or his failure, and, you know, bad things come from that. Now, when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And obviously, you know, very natural, full of, you know, vitamins and, you know, all the things that they would need. So now when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. So here, the people, the army needs nourishment. You know, if anybody knows anything about war, logistics is a very, very big part of it. And, you know, people can only fight for so long with no food and no water and no rations. And so here, by making this, you know, crazy oath, he has, you know, limited the people's ability to strengthen themselves and, you know, be geared up for the battle. But Jonathan, who, remember, went off with his armor bearer and kind of started this whole victory thing, had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. So he put out the tip of his staff that was in his hand, dipped it in the honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. So he doesn't know that his father's done this thing. Just shows how, I don't know if anybody's ever, does anybody know who Bear Grylls is?
Oh, yeah.
So it's interesting if you ever watch his shows. I mean, these people that are these, like, these survivalist people, they'll go for a couple of days and then they'll have some meal of lizard leg or whatever the heck they have. And they're like, wow, I can really feel that I've been restored. And so, you know, it's kind of terrible, and I'm a great example of it, that we grow up in the refrigerator age, that whenever you feel the urge to eat, you go over and pop open the door and have whatever you want, you know, or at least what's in there. But this day and age, you know, food was an issue, or being fed was not necessarily something that was always going to happen. So, you know, obviously by partaking of nutrients and stuff, it instantly pays dividends in their ability to fight. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day,' and the people were faint." So he's just now finding out what his father said, and the people are like, you know, here Jonathan's in good shape, and they're growing faint, but they are listening to the king. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey." So, like I said, Jonathan's like always like one of the most interesting characters that I kind of have enjoyed going through this, you know, kind of in-depth study with, because he never goes against his father, but he always seems to note when his dad's not doing the right thing. But you never see him rebelling against his father. But he does seem to, so it makes his character even more believable in the fact that he points out his father's failings, but he never revolts against it, never becomes the Absalom or somebody like that. "How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they found, for now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great." So again, this silly oath made in a moment of pride or whatever you would call it has cost, you know, they could have had a complete victory. And instead, now, you know, it's been, that victory's been somewhat subdued. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about, you know, young Christians or whatever, and they're just so happy to be saved and just so, you know, want to tell the world about Jesus. We put a bunch of rules on them. You know, you got to know your theology, you got to know your eschatology, you got to know all this. And all the people they could have spoken to, and just with the joy that was in their heart and with the just lovingness of knowing that now they're saved, I once was lost, but now I'm found. We've put a bunch of rules on it, and the victories they could have had have been diminished by somebody's rules. So they stuck down the Philippines that day from Michmash to Aslan, and the people were very faint. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone here to me." So here's the other side of that. So you put a bunch of rules on people that God never meant, and eventually that wears some people down to the point of kind of keep your rules, that they just completely go off the rails, and they're like, "I can't do this. I can't keep your rules. I give up on this. I'm out." So here they've created, you know, obviously this blood. If anybody knows, the blood symbolizes life, you know. So by taking an animal and sacrifices and draining the blood, you've taken its life before, and you've spilled out its life before you consume it. At this point, they're eating something with the life still in it, with what symbolizes the life. So this is a really, really bad, you know, this is against the kosher laws and all that stuff. But because of this crazy rule that was put on them by the king, they have this great victory, but now they're starving. So they just become ravenous wolves, and they're just killing anything they can find and just eating it, which now that rule, it's as bad as it was to sin against the rule, now they've sinned against God. So, you know, again, it goes back to all people laying rules on people that people can't keep, and sometimes the outcome is worse you know, they're just leaving people to let God deal with them and let God speak to their hearts. And, you know, we try to get involved, sometimes with good intentions, sometimes, you know, for reasons, who knows. And it sometimes have some very bad outcomes. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, let every man bring his ox and his sheep and slaughter them here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So every one of the people brought his ox with them, and that night they slaughtered him there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar he built to the Lord. So, again, he's kind of assuming the role of priest. Not a good thing. But at least he realizes that, again, he doesn't realize he caused this problem because he doesn't remand his thing. And obviously that's been violated now too. So here they are. So he's trying to like backtrack and trying to find a way out of this. Then Saul said, let us go up after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. But the priest said, let us draw near to God here. So, obviously, he was assuming some of the priestly duties, but there's priests there, and as many times as we've seen the priests not do well, in this case, it seems that they stepped into the breach, and rightly, up to this point, you've never seen anybody short of Jonathan consult with God and seek his counsel and seek what they should do. And Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of the people? But he did not answer him that day. So there's a bad sign, right? We've committed an atrocity. We've put rules on people. We've done all this, and now we're going to wrap it in religiosity. And now we've done what we said we were going to do, but now we're going to seek God again. You know, we can look at this, and it's easy to criticize. But how many times in your life have you done something, and then you want to pray to God about, help me work this out? You know, because I'm sure this is what you wanted me to do, and now it's a mess, and now I need your help. And, you know, sometimes we don't get the answer that we're hoping for at that given moment. And Saul said, come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For the Lord lives who saves Israel. Though it be Jonathan my son, he will surely die. For there was not a man among the people who answered him. So he doesn't realize what he's saying here. He's kind of making a prophecy that, you know, the first person that broke his oath was his own son. And, you know, kind of to the people's credit, they're like, they're not offering him up and pointing the finger saying, here, he's the problem. They realize, you know, he was the one that started this and gave them the victory.
Chris, that really reminds me exactly like what happened with Jephthah and his daughter, that he made that promise to the first person comes down on my door, I'll sacrifice. You know, he's doing the
exact same thing. So learn history and you're still doomed to repeat it, right? Then he said to all of Israel, you shall be on one side, and Jonathan, my son, and me be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said, O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? Is the guilt in me or Jonathan my son? O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is with your people Israel, give Thurim. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. So this is that, I don't know if any of you have been exposed to the Urim and the Thurim. It's like, almost like dice, I think is the way it's, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what it is, because it wasn't really the way, but it's like casting lots. Basically, you throw this die and you say, hey, if it comes up, you know, black, it's this, and or white, it's this, this kind of thing. That's what this Urim and Thurim is. Thurim. Then Saul said, cast a lot between me and my son Jonathan. and Jonathan was taken. And Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. Jonathan told him, I tasted a little honey with the tip of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I will die. And Saul said, God do so to me and more also. You surely shall die, Jonathan. So this is a pretty... It just keeps spinning off the rails and down into further and further problems. Like, he doesn't have any problem just, you know, putting his son up to die, just sacrificing his son, in that he never looks introspectively and says, oh, God, I have sinned. You know, if anybody should die, it should be me. I did this stupid thing. He's ready to throw his son under to the wolves. Hey, he's got to die. Somebody's got to die. And the fact that he says, God, so to me and more also, you will surely die, Jonathan. I think we'll see this play out prophetically toward the end of Saul's reign. So, but much, we're going to see much to the peoples. Then the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there should not be one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. So it's just, you know, kind of an awesome, you know, it's one of those you can fool all the people some of the time, but not some of the people all the time thing, that they're seeing. You know, he's making these great religious boasts and willing to kill his son and doing all this stuff. And they're like, nah, we ain't having that. You know, this is the guy that really did this. You're running around as king, but you haven't done what he's done. So this ain't happening. Which puts Saul back under the second oath he gave, which is going to play out eventually. So then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So again, instead of having total victory and just, you know, having everything that the Lord wanted them to have, somebody threw a bunch of rules on top of, you know, what the people were doing, and it leads to a partial victory. And the Philistines went to their own place, which happens to be what we're reading in the news every day. So, you know, it's nothing changes in 2, 3, 5, 6,000 years. People are people and do what they do. Then Saul had taken the kingship over Israel. He fought against all the enemies, all his enemies on every side. It's kind of morphed from all the Lord's enemies, it's become all of Saul's enemies. Against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck down the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered him. So basically, if you go through this kind of list, it's like east, west, north, south. It's like they're surrounded on every side, and God gave, which is kind of like today, again, 6,000 years later, read all these exact same things. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishwi, and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merib, and the name of the younger was Michal. So I didn't look up all these names because you never see them really, again, in the Bible, other than Jonathan. But the daughters are kind of important because they're going to play a role later in his kingship or lack thereof. And the name of Saul's wife was Hananun, the daughter of Hemdaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, son of Ner, Saul's uncle. So kind of keeps it in the family, which was kind of a tradition back then. You kept, you know, keep your enemies close, your friends close, and your enemies closer. That was it. So Kish was the father of Saul, and Abner and Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, he attached them to himself. So, kind of goes back, if you'll remember, when Samuel was warning against the king, he said, hey, he's going to take the best. You know, he's going to take your daughters and make them his bakers and all these things. So here you see that kind of playing out. If he, you know, this guy might be the one protecting this particular village from, and Saul's like, no, you're with me. So the kingship can cut both ways. Yeah. Because he's worried about protecting himself now. So, 1 Samuel 15. Let's see how far we get. It's just tough. These are very, very long chapters, and there's not a lot of you can go into other than pretty straightforward. So Samuel said to Saul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. And I went back. So this is in, I'm going to put my glasses on. Exodus 17, verse 8. I thought I had the quote in here. And the Amalekites came and attacked Israel at like Rephaim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men to go out and fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua fought against the Amalekites, and Moses ordered, and Moses and Aaron and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hand, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hand, the Amalekites were winning. And when Moses' hand grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held up his hands on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. And Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord, the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. And I noted that because that's really beyond important later in this chapter. So basically what the Amalekites did first, you figure upwards of 1 million people, such, you know, strolling across the desert, I can imagine that's a pretty long line, and as people got sick or got old or got tired, they tended to filter towards the back of the congregation, and the Amalekites would attack from the rear. So they would pick off pregnant mothers, you know, people that were struggling to keep up with the group. They were easy pickings for these band of raiders that would come and attack the Israelites. So, you know, God does not forget, and so this is going to play out in this chapter. Now go attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them, put them to death, men, women, children, infants, cattle, sheep, camels, and donkeys. And this is one of those places where a lot of people have problems with the Bible. And I have my own personal beliefs. I won't throw it out here, but there's a reason for this to happen. And, you know, God's not vengeful in the sense that he's just going to make this as painful as possible. God is doing this for a reason. I'm going to trust him in that one. So, you know, you can have your problems with it all you want, but, you know, you probably got bigger problems than just that if you're worried about that. So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 from Judah. So again, this is kind of an interesting place where it's kind of picturing into the future, because it's breaking out the tribes of Israel and the tribes of Judah separately. So we're going to see that play out, you know, in the future. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in a ravine. And he said to the Kenites, go away, leave the Amalekites, so that I do not destroy you along with them, for you showed kindness to all the Israelites that came up out of Egypt. So the Canaanites moved away from the Amalekites, and Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Hivlah to Shur, near the eastern border of Egypt. So I just, in case I know, this will be, so I went down a definition of the Kenites, because we should remember them from the book of Judges. So they were a nomadic tribe of ancient Levant, many of whom became affiliated with the Israelites. The Kenites were described as showing kindness to Israel during the Exodus, and later settling among them in the tribal areas of Judah and Naphtali after the conquest of Canaan. They intermarried with the Israelites and were depicted in the Bible narratives as supporting Israel and its fight against the Canaanites and the Amalekites. Among the well-known of the Kenites was Jethro, the priest of Midian, and his daughter Zipporah, who became the wife of Moses and the mother of his two sons. The biblical hero Jael, who slew the Canaanite general Sisa after the battle of Mount Tabor, was the wife of Heber the Kenite. 50 points. What was Heber famous for? Alright, he was a turncoat. If you'll remember, he was helping, so it's kind of interesting that the people that wrote this little quick description kind of left that out of the narrative, that you know, kind of didn't make him the bad guy that he was. But just so we can refresh our minds, it's good to kind of keep going back and see how things fit into the narrative.
Yeah, because when he went, when Sisera went to the tent, he thought he had a friendly person in jail, and she let him in, let him drink the milk from the bowl. When he laid down to sleep, she put the peg through his head.
Correct.
They evidently thought that he was going to protect. She was going to protect.
But it's interesting.
Running.
In that culture, if a man goes into another man's wife's tent and the man is not there, subject to a death penalty.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
she killed, well,
that makes sense. Yeah, that's kind of how you kept. There wasn't a. Yeah. Well, let's put it to you this way. I didn't put your adultery on Facebook anymore back then. That's for sure. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves of the land, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. So, you know, you can make the case they're following the easy part of what God asked them to do and commanded them to do. They're going to do the easy part. But this, all the best sheep, the best cow, they just look too tempting for me to just destroy. I'm not going to kill this, you know, 8-pound longhorn steer. I'm going to take it back to my farm because it'll really, really, really help me out, which in the end becomes, you know, disastrous. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul. But he was told, Saul has gone down to Carmel. There he has set up a monument to his own honor and has turned and gone down to Gilgal. So, again, he just keeps... He's an interesting character in that the lesson is, again, back to the early Christian thing. You first get saved, you know, you're kind of just happy that you're not going to hell anymore. And you're, you know, everybody's going to tell you your life's not going to be a mess anymore, but it's still going to be a mess, but it's going to be a pleasant mess. Okay? So, and you have somebody that you have an advocate, you know, and... But now he had all the advantages. He was everything the world would think a king wanted to be. He had, God even, if you'll remember, surrounded him with like 600 really good guys. And he had all the chances in the world to be successful. you know, just like we do as young Christians and Christians, and as, you know, Paul, the other Saul, talks about finishing the race. And that's where, you know, we talk about no man greater love has a man that he lay down his life for a friend. And you always think growing up, you know, around the military, think this guy diving on a hand grenade and saving all his, but what about the father that just gets up and goes to work and grinds at a dead-end job to feed his family every day, and the guys that just live every day a really, really tough existence, but they're giving their lives for their friends. And it's, you know, to do it once, I mean, I'm not diminishing the act of that, but to do it once and it's over, but to do it daily is what it takes to climb up on that altar and offer yourself daily as a sacrifice, you know? So sometimes we kind of look at the easy route of, you know, just one time you gave your life and it's over, but, you know, it's giving your life, it's finishing the race, it's going through every day, just grinding it out and finishing. And Saul seems to be going the other way. You know, he seems to start it out with everything and has steady, you know, gone downhill since that. Yep, he has become more prideful, more and more prideful. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions." That's got to be an interesting, you know. Well, you know, right off, it's like a little kid when you say, you know, "Were you in the cookies?" And they got the, you know, the chocolate chips all over their face. They're like, "No, wasn't me," you know. And basically that's the exact same thing he's doing here. But Samuel said then, What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears and this lowing of cattle that I hear?" So Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God." Your God. That's an interesting... So we see how this is... It's my victories now. It's your God. You know, we've completely gone off the rails at this point. And... "Sacrifice your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." "Enough," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." "Tell me," Saul replied. So we'll get kind of quick. Samuel said, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, 'Go and completely destroy all those wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you wipe them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" But Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as obeying the Lord? To obey is better than the sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of adultery. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord has rejected you as king." We'll kind of stop there, because this last statement is going to be the focus of Saul's monarchy from here on out. He, like we talked about, he's climbed up on the throne. He's made himself king in his own life, which is even more important than, you know, the kingship he was offered of Israel. And now he's going to try to protect him being on his own throne and the throne of Israel. So his existence from this point on is defending that throne. He's no longer just listening to God and being an instrument of God. His whole focus of life now has changed. And it'll be with horrific consequences for a lot of people involved. So, good place to end. Questions? Anything? Did I miss anything? Anybody have any better?
I thought about movement, monument.
Mausoleum. Yep. Yeah, he's definitely. I was talking with my. We had a bunch of kids at the house Friday. And we were laughing about, you know, how we've all seen the pictures of from the caveman. You know how man's ascending to this perfect being, and you couldn't be more 180 degrees from the truth, right? Man was created perfect, and we're going, you know, straight down. And I'm like, you know, people survived without electricity for how many thousands of years? The world would be 90% wiped out in 2 weeks if there was an EMP attack or some solar flare that wiped out. You know, all the electricity. People knew how to, we think we're the smartest generation. But think about all this stuff, all the knowledge that's stored digitally that would be wiped out. You know, we wouldn't even know how to count to two, I don't think. You know, and sometimes at this point, but that Saul's the example of, you know, this to this, when he thinks he's going from this to this. You know, he started out as humble farmer, and now he's going to, you know, up to king instead of God creating you perfectly and loving you, and now you're disobeying, and the consequences are going to be devastating.
It always amazes me, like, when you read the Bible, in the Old Testament especially, and, you know, I remember when I first became a Christian, and I did think those things, like, oh, my gosh, he killed all these innocent people, and all the, that was horrible, horrible. But as you grow in your faith, I think you realize, I hope we do, that when he said to do this, that's what we should have done, or that's what we should do today, because he is the one that's omniscient. We're not, so why do we keep thinking we are and believe that, well, we'll save the best of those because, you know, we can use them. And I do that with things in my life, and I know it. But if God gave me that command, oh, God, I hope I would follow through because, you know, he's the one that knows the outcome and he knows the reasons. We don't. Our thoughts are not his thoughts. You know, why do we set ourselves up there? But do you know what I mean? Like, we get crazy. It's like, it's insanity when you think about it. We go from sane to insane really quickly.
Back and forth, yeah.
Something like she said, innocent people. Are people really innocent?
Yeah. Well,
you look at it through the right perspective, is there really an innocent person on this earth?
There was one.
Everybody else was born in original sin.
Right.
You're sinful by nature. And that's...
Exactly. But in that, you saw the grace of God.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And you also learned what Jesus said, if those who are for me, if they're with me, you know, if not, they scatter. Well, you see how he dealt with the Kenites, because they were with him at times, yes. And he scattered the Amalekites. I mean, that's just the simple...
Yeah, I think of it like we are corrupt. When I think of children back, you know, when AIDS was so prevalent, you talked about it a lot, and innocent little babies in their mother's womb were being born with HIV and dying from that, you know, I thought, how sad is that, you know, that that could happen, but it's a fallen world, this is a corrupt world, and we have to realize that we're part of that. Like, you know what I mean, like, we, you know, don't put yourself before God.
Well, I mean, think about the interesting fact. I mean, I'm going to shoot a couple thousand years into the future from this. You know who Haman is, right? And the Book of Esther?
Yeah.
Haman's a descendant of the Amalekites and Agag. So somehow, in this, they didn't carry out what was supposed to be done, as brutal as it was, and it came back to bite them in the hindside. And he tried to wipe out the whole nation of Israel.
But God used for good what they meant for evil. And so God is at work in all of that. And we thank God he is, because we would, you know.
Yep. But it just goes to show, you have no idea in the future what those little, not obedience here, what is going to, the fruit of that is going to be in the future.
That's true, but it's all because of God.
Yeah. Agreed. But they're still going to suffer. They still suffer the consequences.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right. Everybody, who wants to close this in prayer? Anybody volunteer? All right, I'll do it. Dear Heavenly Father, just thank you for this day. We thank you for the word, this time together, and Lord, make it just not words on a page and quick speech, that it digs deep into our hearts, and we take it and keep it in mind, Lord, and help us to always be mindful of what you mean, that you always want good for us, and that sometimes we can't even see it, but that you always want good for us. And we just thank you for your son dying on the cross for us, Lord, and just thank you for all your blessings. In Jesus' name, amen.